Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. We're here today on New Books Genocide Studies and New Books Eastern European Studies. I'm Steven Siegel, and my guest today is Dr. Svenja Bethke, who is the author of Dance on the Razor's Edge, Crime and Punishment in the Nazi Ghettos, published by University of Toronto Press, 2021. Welcome, Svenja, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you a lot, Stephen, and thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So I'm grateful for your time, and I want to get started really quickly, but first, your bio. So Svenja Bethke is lecturer in modern European history and deputy director at the Stanley Burton Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at the University of Leicester, UK. She works on the history of modern Europe with an emphasis on the Holocaust and Jewish history in a transnational dimension. From 2019 to 2021, she held a Marie Skłodowska Curie Fellowship at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem for her new project, which we'll also hear about, Clothing, Fashion, and Nation Building in the Land of Israel. Recent publications include Attempts to Take Action in a Coerced Community, Petitions to the Jewish Council in the Lodz or Łódź Ghetto during World War II, 2020, and a special issue of International Journal for Fashion Studies entitled Clothing and Fashion in Historical Perspective, 2019. So our listeners will be familiar with her work both in German and in English, and I'm really happy to see this book come out in English. With University of Toronto Press. So let me start with the very first question, and I hope our listeners, you know, will get an answer because I'm really curious about this too. So could you tell us what motivated you initially to pick up this project and write the book?
Yes, of course. Yeah, and it is a bit of an interesting story because I hadn't really planned it. I mean, I had thought about continuing with the PhD after my postgraduate studies, but I was more interested initially, or that's what I mainly did during my studies in Soviet history. So I thought more along these lines. But then I took up a job. It was for a professor at the university, but it had to do with a very specific law. I'm not sure how many will be familiar with this, but in 2006, there was a German law coming out that allowed Holocaust survivors who had survived ghettos and who had worked in ghettos to be able to make pension claims retrospectively. Mm-hmm. And what I did, or what the professor for whom I worked did, Professor Frank Olszewski, there was a big scandal because many of these claims were not kind of granted, and people had to explain how they worked in the ghettos. And well, it became clear that kind of the idea that was embedded in the law about the working conditions in the ghettos were not really suitable for the situation people had been living in, had been forced to work under. So luckily, historians were then asked to provide the perspective on the working conditions in the ghettos during the Second World War, and were asked to write pieces of expertise. Mm-hmm. To get a more to get a clear understanding. And I was working for this professor, meaning I went through a lot of primary sources, concerning everyday life in these coerced communities during the Second World War, meaning the ghettos. And I also studied law alongside history. So
I see that.
there are kind of then all these questions coming up about what kind of community are we looking at? What kind of coerced communities are we looking at? And how do many different themes and aspects that we can look at in every society, every community, drastically different under these circumstances in the ghettos? And combining my interest in law and legal norms and my interest in history and then the work I did, I started to think about this question: what did this actually mean for ideas about human behavior and how to judge on human behavior? Meaning, which practices were all of a sudden maybe newly defined as being criminal, or which kind of previous offenses continued to matter and in which way? And what did actually happen to enforcing certain kind of judgments on human behavior under these circumstances?
Mm-hmm. I think it's such an interesting self-reflection about this idea of ethics and judgment, and I really want to come back to that. I wonder if you might explain to our readers what kind of thematic structure you decided upon for your book. So you have something that you call the legal sphere or the ghetto internal legal sphere, as far as I understand. So how did you arrange the chapters to your book? I know there was a German edition too, but maybe you could paint a big picture of that for us.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, a bit linked to what I previously said, how I came to the topic, I was, especially at the beginning, looking at, approaches in, legal theory and so on. And because I was so much interested in this question, to what extent was this what I call legal sphere specific and different from other societies, I decided to go with a structure that kind of reflects many of these institutions that we can see in other societies as well. I kind of, while I'm comparing three different ghetto communities, I decided to have a thematic approach and look at different institutions, or even start by asking, first of all, how were newly defined offenses and definitions of what criminality was anchored? Mm-hmm. So how were these communicated? So I looked at proclamations. Then I look at the so-called Jewish police in all three ghettos. So how were these new definitions then enforced, and how were these persecuted? And then I look also at internal ghetto courts. So which role did these courts fulfill? What kind of power did they have? Which legal norms did they use? How were these kind of court proceedings then also publicized? And which role did these fulfill? And then I also look at the kind of penal system in a way.
Exactly.
Kind of interested in what kind of punishment was then enforced, and what were actually the possibilities to enforce ghetto internal punishments. And in the end, because of course it is very important to on one hand, I'm looking at the so-called Jewish Council, so the ghetto internal administration, but to ask the question, which role did actually the ghetto inhabitants play in all of this, and to what extent did they may also make use of internal institutions, what was their view on these internal proceedings, and so on. And I look at a few examples where I'm trying to bring together these two very different kind of groups in a way.
Right. And could you say a word about your sources? So you do have three ghettos, and you decided on Warsaw, Lodz, and Vilna, or Łódź and Vilnius, right? I guess I have a two-part question. First, you know, as someone who worked on the Encyclopedia of Camps and Ghettos for many years for the U.S. Holocaust Museum, I'm curious why you chose those three. That's the first part of the question. And then really, you know, what drew you to not just the memoirs or, you know, let's say the wealth of secondary literature, but what drew you to delve a lot deeper into crime and punishment in those three situations, in those three ghettos?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, before I answer that question, I would just like to add, I mean, I did mention when you ask about the structure that, of course, what I said about the internal institutions and procedures, my first chapter is actually on Nazi Jewish policy and in a way on German definitions. So just to have kind of the framework.
We can talk about that. We'll talk about that.
Okay. So regarding the sources, why these ghettos? I mean, as many will know, I've chosen ghettos where we do already have very important research on these communities, quite often, these histories of everyday life to some extent. And I chose them for the same reason that we do have more research than, for example, smaller ghettos, which is that there were kind of very rich internal ghetto archives that allow us to make use of internal documentation, quite often linked to very comprehensive internal ghetto administration that were quite often kept in secret archives that were gathered by personnel that was employed by the Jewish Council and that was then hidden from the Germans, which then allows us today to make use of these extraordinary primary sources on one hand. And this brings me to the question, what kind of primary sources I'm using or have used, is that on one hand, we have this comprehensive documentation of institutions and practices on the side of the Jewish councils, meaning the internal ghetto administration. We also have a lot of exchange, because, of course, everything I'm talking about here can only be seen in the context of German orders and German intervention to a certain degree. And we have a lot of exchange between the German administrative authorities and the ghetto internal authorities. So this is relevant to my topic. And then quite often also testimonies of ghetto inhabitants that were gathered in these internal archives, as well as chronicles that are very, very important source when looking at, for instance, incidents that happened, criminal cases that were considered worth mentioning by these institutions.
Exactly. And I guess, you know, I'll return to this as well. I'd love it if you could talk about some of the less popular sources. I mean, people who will read Ringelblum or Spielmann or, you know, Edelmann and so forth, that might not know of the richness of a lot of these sources and documents that you discovered in these archives. And so, you know, I'd love it if you would be talking about that for the three ghettos. But you know, first, I did want to ask a question about these definitions of crime and punishment. And really, I think from your first chapter forward, you have a really interesting take on the ghettoization of the population and the extent to which, let's say, the legal sphere is autonomous or pseudo-autonomous. I guess this is an old debate, but maybe you could talk a little bit about how you understand the role of the Judenräte or the Jewish councils within the three ghettos, given the relative lack or let's say absence of autonomy. I don't know if I'm correct about that, but I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. This is really at the core of what I've looked at, and it concerns broader debates, as you've said, on to what extent were the Jewish councils actually able to define and then enforce their own take on certain things happening in the ghetto and so on. And what I was quite surprised by, I mean, of course, we do not have to, it's not about questioning that these were coerced communities, the Jewish councils were forced to take over these positions and the role. But nonetheless, in these earlier debates, they were quite often seen as the puppets of the Nazis and so on. But nonetheless, what I discovered when looking at what I call this legal sphere is that it was not because the Germans were so generous. Mostly it was because they didn't really care, or they cared about the ghetto being calm and them being able to enforce whatever they were interested in at the moment. But this did allow to a certain degree internally for the Jewish councils to decide how they would go about certain institutions, certain procedures, and so on. And I would argue that this so-called legal sphere is quite representative for a certain room for maneuver and also attempts to decide with a certain autonomy how things should be and could be organized, always with the attempt to avoid the intervention of the Germans, to avoid them coming in the ghetto or taking over and concerns later on also these legal procedures and taking out prisoners or out of the ghetto prisons, for example. But what I would say, what we see throughout from the establishment of the ghettos until the very end, that this desperate attempt to trying to make use of scope for action in the ghettos, which was quite often possible, but it changed throughout the years of the existence.
Mm-hmm. And could you talk a little bit about, again, back to the thematic structure of your book, how you almost like in a way of concentric circles define this criminality, because there are so many different examples of crime, right? So you have border crossing, you have smuggling, you have murder, you have rape. I mean, there are all sorts of examples, trafficking. How do you conceive of that through the book? And then I guess this is my question about how you decided to lay out your chapters, if you could give our audience maybe an idea of how you did that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Again, this is, of course, it was one of the most difficult questions when I first went to the archives, and you don't really find these files saying criminal offences and so on. So finding a way of getting clarity which actions were seen as criminal and what the consequences were. And I just make a very general point. I mean, my approach, and this is where, maybe my legal approaches also came in here, is to say, and it's quite obvious, but there is not an objective definition of what crime is. So every society, community defines that in its own way. But of course, when we look at the ghettos, we have to take into account the enforced definitions and orders of the Germans. So What I did was that I first looked at the definitions that were like the practices and actions that were officially defined as criminal by the Germans, and then what the Germans asked the Jewish councils to do about certain offenses. And this is what you just mentioned, for example, illegal border crossing, smuggling, and so on. Right. And these are usually the
classical
things that come to mind.
Classical crimes, so-called, right? I mean, those were also like sort of private, deemed private as far as I understand, or I mean, how, like brawls or murders or...
Yeah, let me...
go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
Go ahead.
Maybe I didn't make it clear enough yet. So what I did is that I came up with certain categories that I recognize throughout these different ghettos. So on one hand, we have offenses that were officially defined by the Germans, and the Germans ordered the Jewish councils to persecute these offenses and then in some cases also report back to them. So this is on one hand the German offenses. Secondly, I found so many examples where the Jewish councils and their institutions internally defined very unusual practices as criminal. So I came to the second category where I said, apparently the Jewish councils came up with new definitions trying to punish certain behaviors and actions that they deemed as very dangerous for the ghetto community. And they deemed them as very dangerous in cases where they thought this could provoke the intervention of the Germans. And I'm talking here really about a broad range of illegal production of sweets, illegal production of sausages. You find these really repeatedly in the primary sources. And then you have to ask, why were these, why was this seen as criminal, and why did the Jewish councils punish these? And then you need to understand first, and then to explain that, of course, they justified it by being afraid that diseases may spread if people would produce food at home and would not comply with hygienic measures that would be needed, and then knowing that there was knowledge that the Germans thought all the time, diseases will spread in the ghettos, and that the spread of diseases may then lead to German intervention and maybe brutal consequences. Annihilation of the ghetto community. And for each offense that I kind of recognized and that came up several times, I always ask myself, what is the justification for this? What was given as a reason why this was punished? And how? What does this tell us about everyday life under these circumstances? Under this category, we have really a broad range of quite unusual criminal offenses, I would say.
I mean, I have to say, I'm amazed at your attention, like really, really careful and detailed attention to personnel in this Alltagsgeschichte, because, you do get right into the ghetto talking about not just the changes of the leadership, but looking at, the newspapers like Gazeta Żydowska or Ghetto Zeitung or, other examples. And I'm really curious as to how, you sort of begin to reconstruct these characters. Maybe you could give an example or two. I mean, they're the famous example of Chernyakov, right, and his suicide, but maybe some names that our audience might not know. You have librarians and, people who involve themselves with, who are functionaries, but are involved with the legal departments. I mean, what attracted you to their stories? And then, of course, how did you pursue their prosecution of crimes if they were simple functionaries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit linked to, well, not a bit, what I now said about the change of these legal norms. And early on, you also asked for these classical crimes. And I just mentioned that. And then I come to the point, because I think it's quite relevant, that, of course, what you mentioned as classic crimes, for instance, there were cases of sexual abuse, there were cases of rape, there were cases of theft, I mean, many cases of theft. And these were also persecuted, but in a different way, and less attention was given to these. So when I look then at the personnel, I was very much interested in the background that these people had. What made them choose, or sometimes maybe not even choose, to pursue a legal profession in the ghettos? What was their background? Where had they studied? What had they studied? So to understand what kind of legal norms they were familiar with, and then trying to find out, and in some cases, for example, Stanislav Adler was with the Jewish police in the Warsaw ghetto, but was responsible for thinking about new legal procedures. He, like, we have, an extraordinary autobiography written by him, where he explains, like, it's so fascinating about his motivation to think about how to adjust and to what extent this needs to be adjusted under the circumstances in the ghetto. And wherever I could find something about the motivation, about the background of these people, and also their reflection on why would legal procedures be needed. And what is so interesting about this context, well, of the ghettos, is it has so much to do with what they knew about the German plans, what they experienced in their everyday life, what they thought would happen. So I think what is so
interesting... That's a great point.
Yeah, about legal norms, it has so much to do with the future in a way. And it is all about, why do we punish someone for something? Because we want to prevent an action, or we want to kind of send a message to the community, this is forbidden. But what comes up in the primary sources is also that so many of them were thinking about, if we don't punish this, what will people think after the war? How will they judge our behavior? So, this is what I find so fascinating, that even in the Vilna ghetto, where the plans of the Germans to systematically murder the ghetto population were known almost from the very beginning, and nonetheless, these judges, for example, operating in the Vilna ghetto, were still thinking about, if we survive this, what will people say about the way we acted under these circumstances with regards to punishment of criminal offenses.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a good idea of when criminals or criminality becomes resistance? Because, again, this is sort of a big question,
yes,
right? I mean, almost impossible to answer this. But given all the files that you looked at and the cases of, let's say, very violent crime, or let's say the cases of leniency towards some of those who were prosecuted. I mean, how then do you decide what forms of gang behavior or criminality represent resistance? I mean, this is a huge issue, for Holocaust historiography, right? But I guess I have to ask this because of all the work that you did on these three ghettos. I mean, when does criminality become a form of resistance?
Yeah, it's, I think, one of the most difficult questions to answer, because as you will have seen that, I mean, I discussed this, but, well, let me make at least 2 points. First of all, again, as much as we have to ask what is defined as criminality, we have to ask what is defined as resistance. So, of course, there's a big difference about what today in scholarship is defined as resistance when looking back at behavior in the ghettos, and what was defined as resistance during the time of the existence of the ghettos. So that doesn't make it easier, but were you referring to this overall question, right? So
yeah, I think so. If it's a big question, but maybe you could break it down if you have a couple of examples of this. So you have so many rich examples of when there is leniency shown for the individuals, but there are also, you know, cases including those of sexual violence where people really are prosecuted and there are death penalties which are given.
Yeah, I mean, I would first look at the context of the ghetto, and I think it can clarify a little bit why I think it's so important to be so kind of exact about which situation are we talking about and what is defined as resistance. And where we do have cases that are defined during the existence of the ghetto as resistance, and this means from the perspective of the Jewish Council, resistance to their ghetto institutions that they set up, resistance to the Jewish police. And we do also have, importantly, in the Vilna ghetto and also in the Warsaw ghetto, cases of armed resistance. So, interestingly, and this is something because, initially everyone asked, so how did they judge on cases of armed resistance? And as we know, Jewish Council heads were deferred drastically in their take on armed resistance. But what becomes quite clear is that these cases hardly come up, for example, in these court proceedings and so on, that I do think, and this is, of course, relevant for all these primary sources and the question, what did they want to write down? That my impression is, and it's also what I could get from certain primary sources, that cases of armed resistance that by some Jewish councils were seen as endangering the whole ghetto community because of its danger, the danger that the Germans may intervene, do not really appear in these kind of court proceedings or when the Jewish police arrested ghetto inhabitants. In the Vilna ghetto, towards the end, it does come up, and Jakub Genz, as the Jewish council head, gives a number of speeches where he says, from now on, the Jewish police will be asked to persecute cases of armed resistance, and kind of explains why this is so important and that he will now take a different take on this. So this regards the question, what was defined as resistance internally in the ghettos? Later on, and this is then almost more about the historiography, we have this whole shift, and I'm trying not to go too much into detail, but luckily, new interest in everyday life in the ghetto communities, especially since the 1990s, since we have access to these primary sources in many Eastern European archives. All of a sudden, with this kind of very broad definition of Jewish resistance as any act that is directed towards German intentions and actions, examples and themes were all of a sudden seen as resistance against the Nazis. And this is what I can see also with the with criminality, that smuggling was all of a sudden seen as resistance to the Nazis' intentions. And we can see this for many other criminal offenses that were then seen as this was resistance. And I'm not questioning this overall, but I do not think it is specifically helpful because it kind of blurs our perspective on it. And there were also professionally organized smugglers. If we use this broad definition, Amida, of course, this can be seen as resistance, but I do think what I really try to do is look more at the ghetto context and look at a variety of motivations that led people to behave in very different ways. And not quickly jump to just saying, looking from back from today with what we know, this was all resistance.
Yeah, and I mean, I like your answer to that. I remember Gulchevsky had the Lebensweld ghetto project, maybe it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago now. But the importance of reconstructing the norms and, let's say, historical context for decisions when they're made by legal personnel and then in a functionary capacity, I think is exceptionally important. And that leads me to another question, which I think is a really great and big point in your book. And it's about this continuity versus rupture with, older models, let's say, not just in interwar Poland, but older models of Jewish courts, maybe even all the way back to the Pierwsza Rzeczpospolita, to the first Polish-Lithuanian Republic. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that insofar as you see, both continuity and rupture among the Jewish judges and courts and legal practices and behaviors within the ghettos.
Yes, of course. And I agree. This is a very important point. And what is quite helpful here is, again, the question, what did the legal personnel see as a continuity and as a rupture? And I think looking at this theme of continuity, initially, because many of these people then working in these legal roles, the first point of continuity was their education and their background and what they were used to do. So quite often they were asked to function in certain roles, for example, as a judge, because they had studied law and so on. But what is quite obvious, and this is where this comparison between these three ghettos is quite useful, that I always try to find out at what point did the legal personnel or also the Jewish councils have a sense of this is completely different what we are facing here. I mean, of course, it was clear from the beginning, but when did this kind of translate to we have to do things differently? And what is quite interesting that even in the Vilna ghetto, where I said it was quite clear from what people experienced from the very beginning, that it was very unlikely that all of the ghetto community would survive, if anyone, and that nonetheless these courts were set up, and the first attempt to establish certain norms was to make use of pre-war legal norms. But then there was another meeting that was called in where I think after a few weeks they said, this doesn't work and we are operating under an emergency situation and we cannot apply this. And so then this shifted and there was much more flexibility in the way these norms were then used. And we see the same in, for example, in the Lodz ghetto, but we have a longer period initially where there were still attempts to make use of pre-war legal norms, but it took a bit longer, and of course they were established earlier, but there as well it was kind of a topic of discussions. To what extent do we have a continuity? Can we make use of our knowledge? And when do we have to recognize that this doesn't work and that we have to operate differently?
Mm-hmm. And could you say, again, with the scholarship, there's a lot that had been written about this so-called heightened Jewish morality. I mean, I know, one of the things you're doing is complicating that picture, but I guess, how do you complicate that picture by studying behavioral patterns? And here I have in mind, very serious crimes, especially sexual crimes that go unprosecuted. So, when we're dealing with crimes among members of the ghetto, how do you read this? sort of notion that persists so often among survivors in their accounts after the war.
Yeah, I mean, of course it is. This is very relevant to all of what I'm doing, and I'm starting also with that in my introduction, that my intention is not to come to a conclusion how much criminality there was. And my intention is not to say, look, all these awful things happened in the ghetto. What I'm trying to do is move away from this idea that, I mean, and this goes back to, first of all, recognizing that these were coerced communities with people defined as Jewish by the Nazis. So we have very heterogeneous communities under these horrible circumstances, and all kinds of human behaviors occurred under these circumstances. And this is the point I want to make, that then the question is, which of these behaviors were seen as criminal by whom? And because you brought up this aspect of the sexual abuse and rape. And what the only thing I want to show here is that this is kind of a classical crime that we all would agree, yes, this is a serious crime, this should have to be persecuted, and this is what we are used to. But what I try to show is that priorities shifted under the circumstances in the ghettos, and I'm not judging if this is good or bad, I'm just trying to explain why certain priorities were set when all of a sudden these maybe pre-war classical offenses that we are familiar with, or that people also in the ghetto initially were familiar with, became less important because they were maybe dangerous for an individual, but not for the whole ghetto community. And this is one of the main points I'm making, that there was more and more emphasis on actions that could endanger the whole ghetto community in comparison to those more classical crimes that were concerning individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I, you know, you talk about this, I think, at great length in the conclusion with Gringaus and the heightened morality idea. And I'm not just thinking about sexual crimes either, but also the history of denunciations. And I mean, that's so problematic. And you know, I wonder if you might say something about that in the three ghettos, because that also is a changing relationship and really dependent on context. And then it's remembered in very different ways by those who are survivors. So, I mean, how do you read that, you know, level of improvisation through the context of the three ghettos that you study?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe this is an occasion to look a bit more at this theme of like the ordinary ghetto inhabitants, although of course this was happening across all different segments of the ghetto communities. But I looked at the number of cases where ghetto inhabitants went to the Jewish police station and said, my neighbor has stolen this from me, or I have seen someone running around with the shoes that I bought for my daughter, and please can you persecute this person, or where it comes to court proceedings, and it's quite clear that this is the consequence of someone denunciating someone, or just telling someone about it, and then this comes up. And here again, what I want to make clear is that what motivated people under these circumstances has to be seen in this context of suffering these circumstances in the ghettos, with hunger, with wanting to take revenge in some cases, which is also a theme in some court proceedings. Here again, it's not about saying these things didn't occur, and it's also not about saying, oh, it's important to, it, it's a very, as I said, heterogeneous community under coerced circumstances, facing these unbearable situations. And then one way of trying to end certain problems was maybe seen in making use of institutions that existed. And importantly, especially in the Lodz ghetto with Mordechai Chaim Umkowski as the Jewish council head, this was also quite often encouraged by the Jewish councils. They were encouraging people to report these newly defined criminal offenses. It's important to see that people did make use of these possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, my last question for you, because you have so many languages, I mean, you've really, you know, this is why people have to read the book. A podcast can't possibly capture, you know, everything. But you've got sources in Polish and German and Yiddish, and I think some Hebrew as well, and other languages. I'm wondering if you might, you know, talk a bit about future research and what could be done further on some of the ghettos like Šiauliai and maybe in the ones in Lithuania that are not in your book. Given all of your languages and especially the Polish sources that you've looked at, what things might you suggest to future historians or others who might take an interest in looking at your work and the history of the ghettos and the Holocaust?
Mm. Yeah, there are many, many things that should be done. And I mean, for example, starting with these kind of very important topics that are like the context of my book, but where I realized there isn't much research on it. For example, looking at the German definitions, first of all, to understand that they were also highly improvised and theory and practice were clashing all of the time. So how could the Jewish councils make sense of this if they didn't know what the Germans would be interested in or not? So systematically looking, first of all, at these also new definitions by the German occupying forces is very important. And luckily, I have a PhD student now, Judith Föcker, who is writing a thesis on the topic. So,
fabulous.
I very much look forward to her finishing that project. She's doing really interesting work on German courts in occupied Poland. So that is one thing. And then, for example, I mean, you mentioned other ghettos, and as we have clarified, I worked on large ghetto communities. Of course, it would be very important to look at smaller ghettos as well as you said, yes, ghettos in other occupied territories. And especially with smaller ghettos, this question of people knowing each other and other kinds of relationships.
I was going to ask about that. Exactly.
What I know and what I've seen is, of course, there were not institutions comparable to what I've seen in these larger ghetto communities. But then how did people go about deciding in quarrels that people had with their neighbor, for example? So these more improvised, informal ways of dealing with internal problems would be very interesting. And also something that I've given one paper on that at the conference once, but it's certainly something where I would hope to see more research on, is also this question of oral history testimonies looking back at what happened in the ghettos and how certain actions were then reconsidered and rephrased depending on what after the war was seen as, okay, it's okay that I've done this, or this is not okay that I've done it. So at what point did people talk about what they did as resistance because the perception after the war shifted? Or what did they maybe highlight, what others did, because there was a very, new definitions of what would be seen as this was okay or not okay, which then quite often meant this was seen as, morally okay or not.
Right. I mean, it's hard to do this as a historian, because then you're getting into, you know, the intimacy of violence, right? Yeah. I mean, relationships among people who know each other, I mean, either, you know, within the ghetto or maybe even in pre-war contexts, it's, I guess, really hard to read, you know, through court documents from the Lodz special court or the Kriminalkommissariat and find, you know, who might have known another person. But I'm really intrigued by how you managed to pull all of this off, covering both the penal system and the, you know, the primary and secondary sources that you look at. So thank you for that. And maybe now you could talk about your current research, since you worked on this book for so many years. I understand that you're working on clothing and fashion. Could you say a little bit about that and your other projects?
Yes, so I have a new project that will hopefully, it will become my second book, and geographically and thematically, it's a drastic change. So I'm interested in the influence of Eastern European and German immigrants to Eretz Israel, so that first Mandate Palestine, and then Israel. And their influence in anchoring certain ideals of clothing, and then their influence in the emergence of a textile industry during this time. And I'm asking the overall question, what this has to do with nation building, which role the idea of a certain way of dressing, and there were many different ideas of how one should dress, played in this kind of process of nation building since the 1880s, so with large scale Jewish immigration starting in the region and then until the foundation of the Israeli state in 1948, which fell together with the kind of slowly the emergence of a textile industry mm-hmm. in the region.
And would you recommend any particular authors, either on the new subject of your research or on this current book on the history of the ghettos? And maybe our listeners, you know, they always ask me to ask authors if you could possibly suggest other books to read.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, I mean, I've been working on this book for so many years, and at the same time, colleagues of mine have been working on related topics, and you will certainly know, but it's important to mention that I think there are now two books, and we did our research at about the same time. So Katarzyna Persson's book on the Warsaw Ghetto Police, it's a colleague of mine, and I would highly recommend her book. I read it. She allowed me to read the manuscript. So this is kind of looking more at one institution I looked at as well, and what she does. And in my introduction, I say, well, there's so little on the perspective of, like, the people working, for instance, in the Jewish police, and also moving away from this image of the evil ghetto police. And she is one of the a few ones who has looked at it in a very different way and gives a fresh perspective to this. And it's in many ways related to what I've done. But she focuses on the Jewish police in the Warsaw Ghetto. And then there's also Anna Aikova's book, The Last Ghetto, on the Theresienstadt Ghetto, which also, I mean, it's on a different ghetto, and she has this everyday life approach. But I think where our books are similar in a way in the approach is looking at these communities as heterogeneous communities, coerced communities, in which themes that we know of for other communities took very specific forms. But moving away from this idea of this was a Jewish community and everything was fine.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, I've had Anna on the podcast, and I will have Kasia as well hopefully in May. So and I'm really looking forward to your new work. So I wanted to thank you, you know, for taking the time to join me in conversation. This is Steven Siegel. We have been speaking with Dr. Svenja Bethke, who is the author of Dance on the Razor's Edge, Crime and Punishment in the Nazi Ghettos, a new book published by University of Toronto Press, 2021. I want to congratulate you on this wonderful book, and thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you.
And for the New Books Network and New Books in Genocide Studies and New Books in Eastern European Studies, as well as New Books in Jewish Studies, this is Stephen Siegel. Until next time.